and standing in the rain with his eyeball in his palm. He looked to be in great pain, but there was nothing that I could do for him. The naked man may have been the same victim one of Hachiya's later visitors remembered noticing, or he may have been another. There were so many burned at a first aid station that the odor was like drying squid. They looked like boiled octopuses. I saw a man whose eye had been torn out by an injury, and there he stood, with his eye resting in the palm of his hand. What made my blood run cold was that it looked like the eye was staring at me. The people ran to the rivers to escape the firestorm. In the testimony of the survivors, there is an entire sub-literature of the rivers. A third-grade boy. Men whose whole bodies were covered with blood and women whose skin hung from them like a kimono plunged shrieking into the river. All these became corpses, and their bodies are carried by the current toward the sea. A first-grade girl. We were still in the river by evening, and it got cold. No matter where you looked, there was nothing but burned people all around. A sixth-grade girl. Bloated corpses were drifting in those seven formerly beautiful rivers, smashing cruelly into bits the childish pleasure of the little girl. The peculiar odor of burning human flesh rose everywhere in the Delta City, which had changed to a waste of scorched earth. A young ship designer, whose response to the bombing was to rush home immediately to Nagasaki. I had to cross the river to reach the station. As I came to the river and went down the bank to the water, I found that the stream was filled with dead bodies. I started to cross by crawling over the corpses on my hands and knees. As I got about a third of the way across, a dead body began to sink under my weight, and I went into the water, wetting my burned skin. It pained severely. I could go no further, as there was a break in the bridge of corpses. So I turned back to the shore. A third-grade boy. I got terribly thirsty, so I went to the river to drink. From upstream, a great many black and burned corpses came floating down the river. I pushed them away and drank the water. At the margin of the river, there were corpses, lying all over the place. A fifth-grade boy. The river became not a stream of flowing water, but rather a stream of drifting dead bodies. No matter how much I might exaggerate the stories of the burned people who died shrieking, and of how the city of Hiroshima was burned to the ground, the facts would still be clearly more terrible. Terrible was what a Hachiya patient found beyond the river. There was a man, stone dead, sitting on a bicycle as it leaned against a bridge railing. You could tell that many had gone down to the river to get a drink of water and had died where they lay. I saw a few live people still in the water, knocking against the dead as they floated down the river. There must have been hundreds of thousands who fled to the river to escape the fire and then drown. The sight of the soldiers, though, was more dreadful than the dead people floating down the river. I came onto I don't know how many, burned from the hips up, and where the skin had peeled, their flesh was wet and mushy. And they had no faces. Their eyes, noses, and mouths had been burned away, and it looked like their ears had melted off. It was hard to tell front from back. The suffering in the crowded private park of the Asano family was doubled when survivors faced death a second time, another Hachiya confidant saw. Hundreds of people sought refuge in the Asano Sentai Park. They had refuge from the approaching flames for a little while, but gradually the fire forced them nearer and nearer the river, until at length everyone was crowded onto the steep bank overlooking the river. Even though the river is more than 100 meters wide along the border of the park, balls of fire were being carried through the air from the opposite shore, and soon the pine trees in the park were afire. The poor people faced a fiery death if they stayed in the park, and a watery grave if they jumped in the river. I could hear shouting and crying, and in a few minutes they began to fall like toppling dominoes into the river. Hundreds upon hundreds jumped or were pushed in the river at this deep, treacherous point, and most were drowned. Along the streetcar line circling the western border of the park, adds Hachia, they found so many dead and wounded they could hardly walk. The setting of the sun brought no relief. A 14-year-old boy. Night came, and I could hear many voices crying and groaning with pain and begging for water. Someone cried, "Damn it, war tortures so many people who are innocent." Another said, "I hurt, give me water." This person was so burned that we couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. The sky was red with flames. It was burning as if scorching heaven. A fifth-grade girl. Everybody in the shelter was crying out loud. Those voices, they aren't cries, they are moans that penetrate to the marrow of your bones and make your hair stand on end. I do not know how many times I called begging that they would cut off my burned arms and legs. A 6-year-old boy. If you think of brother's body divided into left and right halves, he was burned on the right side and on the inside of the left side. That night brother's body swelled up terribly badly. He looked just like a bronze Buddha. At Donbara High School Field Hospital, every classroom was full of dreadfully burned people who were lying about or getting up restlessly. They were all painted with mercurochrome and white salve, and they looked like red devils, and they were waving their arms around like ghosts and groaning and shrieking. Soldiers were dressing their burns. The next morning, remembers a boy who was 5 years old at the time, Hiroshima was all a wasted land. The Jesuit, coming in from a suburb to aid his brothers, testifies to the extent of the destruction. The bright day now reveals the frightful picture which last night's darkness had partly concealed. Where the city stood, everything as far as the eye could reach, is a waste of ashes and ruin. Only several skeletons of buildings completely burned out in the interior remain. The banks of the rivers are covered with dead and wounded, and the rising waters have here and there covered some of the corpses. On the broad street in the Hakushima district, naked, burned cadavers are particularly numerous. Among them are the wounded who are still alive. A few have crawled under the burned-out autos and trams. Frightfully injured forms beckon to us and then collapse. Hachia corroborates the priest's report. The streets were deserted except for the dead. Some looked as if they had been frozen by death while still in the full action of flight. Others lay sprawled as though some giant had flung them to their death from a great height. Nothing remained except a few buildings of reinforced concrete. For acres and acres, the city was like a desert, except for scattered piles of brick and roof tile. I had to revise my meaning of the word destruction or choose some other word to describe what I saw. Devastation may be a better word, but really, I know of no word or words to describe the view. The history professor Lifton interviewed is similarly at a loss. I climbed Hikiyama Hill and looked down. I saw that Hiroshima had disappeared. I was shocked by the sight. What I felt then, and still feel now, I just can't explain with words. Of course, I saw many dreadful scenes after that, but that experience, looking down and finding nothing left of Hiroshima, was so shocking that I simply can't express what I felt. Hiroshima didn't exist. That was mainly what I saw. Hiroshima just didn't exist. Without familiar landmarks, the streets filled with rubble, many had difficulty finding their way. For Yoko Ota, the city's history itself had been demolished. I reached a bridge and saw that the Hiroshima castle had been completely leveled to the ground, and my heart shook like a great wave. the city of Hiroshima, entirely on flat land, was made three-dimensional by the existence of the White Castle, and because of this it could retain a classical flavor. Hiroshima had a history of its own. And when I thought about these things, the grief of stepping over the corpses of history pressed upon my heart. Of 76,000 buildings in Hiroshima, 70,000 were damaged or destroyed, 48,000 totally. It is no exaggeration to say, reports the Japanese study, that the whole city was ruined instantaneously. Material losses alone equaled the annual incomes of more than 1.1 million people. In Hiroshima, many major facilities, prefectural office, city hall, fire departments, police stations, national railroad stations, post offices, telegram and telephone offices, broadcasting station, and schools, were totally demolished or burned. Streetcars, roads, and electricity, gas, water, and sewage facilities were ruined beyond use. 18 emergency hospitals and 32 first aid clinics were destroyed. 90% of all medical personnel in the city were killed or disabled. Not many of the survivors worried about buildings. They had all they could do to deal with their injuries and find and cremate their dead, an obligation of particular importance to the Japanese. A man remembers seeing a woman bloody in torn wartime Mompei pantaloons, naked above the waist, her child strapped to her back, carrying a soldier's helmet. She was in search of a place to cremate her dead child. The burned face of the child on her back was infested with maggots. I guess she was thinking of putting her child's bones in a battle helmet she had picked up. I feared she would have to go far to find burnable material to cremate her child. A young woman who had been in charge of a firebreak group and who was badly burned on one shoulder, recalls the mass cremations. "We gathered the dead bodies and made big mountains of the dead and put oil on them and burned them. And people who were unconscious woke up in the piles of the dead when they found themselves burning and came running out." Another Hachiya visitor. "After a couple of days, there were so many bodies stacked up, no one knew who was who, and decomposition was so extensive, the smell was unbearable. During those days, wherever you went, there were so many dead lying around, it was impossible to walk without encountering them. Swollen, discolored bodies, with froth oozing from their noses and mouths." A first-grade girl. "On the morning of the 9th, what the soldiers on the clearance team lifted out of the ruins was the very much changed shape of Father. The civil defense post where he worked was at Yasuda near Kyobayashi, in front of the tall chimney that was demolished last year. He must have died there at the foot of it. His head was already just a white skull. Mother and my little sister and I, without thinking, clutched that dead body and wailed. After that, Mother went with it to the crematory at Matsukawa, where she found corpses piled up like a mountain." Having moved his hospital sickbed to a second-floor room with blown-out windows that fire had sterilized, Hachiya himself could view and smell the ruins. Towards evening, a light southerly wind blowing across the city wafted to us an odor suggestive of burning sardines. Towards Nigitsu was an especially large fire where the dead were being burned by the hundreds. These glowing ruins and the blazing funeral pyres set me to wondering if Pompeii had not looked like this during its last days. But I think there were not so many dead in Pompeii as there were in Hiroshima. Those who did not die seemed for a time to improve. But then, explains Lifton, they sickened. Survivors began to notice in themselves and others a strange form of illness. It consisted of nausea, vomiting, and loss of appetite, diarrhea with large amounts of blood in the stools, fever and weakness. Purple spots on various parts of the body from bleeding into the skin. Inflammation and ulceration of the mouth, throat, and gums. Bleeding from the mouth, gums, throat, rectum, and urinary tract. Loss of hair from the scalp and other parts of the body. Extremely low white blood cell counts when those were taken, and in many cases, a progressive course until death. Only gradually did the few surviving and overworked Japanese doctors realize that they were seeing radiation sickness. Atomic bomb illness, explains the authoritative Japanese study, is the first and only example of heavy, lethal, and momentary doses of whole-body irradiation in the history of medicine. A few human beings had been accidentally overexposed to X-rays, and laboratory animals had been exposed and sacrificed for study, but no large population had ever experienced so extensive and deadly an assault of ionizing radiation before. The radiation brought further suffering. Hachiya reports in his diary, "Following the pika, we thought that by giving treatment to those who were burned or injured, recovery would follow. But now it was obvious that this was not true. People who appeared to be recovering developed other symptoms that caused them to die. So many patients died without our understanding the cause of death that we were all in despair. Hundreds of patients died during the first few days. Then the death rate declined. Now it was increasing again. As time passed, anorexia, that is loss of appetite, and diarrhea proved to be the most persistent symptoms in patients who fail to recover. Direct gamma radiation from the bomb had damaged tissue throughout the bodies of the exposed. The destruction required cell division to manifest itself, but radiation temporarily suppresses cell division, hence the delayed onset of symptoms. The blood-forming tissues were damaged worst, particularly those that produce the white blood cells that fight infection. Large doses of radiation also stimulate the production of an anti-clotting factor. The outcome of these assaults was massive tissue death, massive hemorrhage, and massive infection. Hemorrhage was the cause of death in all our cases, writes Hachiya. But he also notes that the pathologist at his hospital found changes in every organ of the body in the cases he autopsied. Liebau reports evidence of generalization of infection with masses of bacteria in organs as remote from the surface of the body as the brain, bone marrow, and eye. The operator of a crematorium in the Hiroshima suburbs, a connoisseur of mortality, told Lifton, "The bodies were black in color. Most of them had a peculiar smell, and everyone thought this was from the bomb. The smell, when they burned, was caused by the fact that these bodies were decayed, many of them even before being cremated, some of them having their internal organs decay even while the person was living." Yoko Ota raged. "We were being killed against our will by something completely unknown to us. It is the misery of being thrown into a world of new terror and fear, a world more unknown than that of people sick with cancer." In the depths of his loss, a boy who was a fourth grader at Hiroshima found words for the unspeakable. "Mother was completely bedridden. The hair of her head had almost all fallen out. Her chest was festering, and from the 2-inch hole in her back, a lot of maggots were crawling in and out. The place was full of flies and mosquitoes and fleas, and an awfully bad smell hung over everything. Everywhere I looked, there were many people like this who couldn't move. From the evening when we arrived, Mother's condition got worse, and we seemed to see her weakening before our eyes. Because all night long she was having trouble breathing, we did everything we could to relieve her. The next morning, Grandmother and I fixed some gruel. As we took it to Mother, she breathed her last breath. When we thought she had stopped breathing altogether, She took one deep breath and did not breathe any more after that. This was 9 o'clock in the morning of the 19th of August. At the site of the Japan Red Cross Hospital, the smell of the bodies being cremated is overpowering. Too much sorrow makes me like a stranger to myself. And yet, despite my grief, I cannot cry. Not human beings alone died at Hiroshima. Something else was destroyed as well, the Japanese study explains. That shared life, Hannah Arendt calls the common world. In the case of an atomic bombing, a community does not merely receive an impact. The community itself is destroyed. Within 2 kilometers of the atomic bomb's hypocenter, all life and property were shattered, burned, and buried under ashes. The visible forms of the city, where people once carried on their daily lives, vanished without a trace. The destruction was sudden and thorough. There was virtually no chance to escape. Citizens who had lost no family members in the Holocaust were as rare as stars at sunrise. The atomic bomb had blasted and burned hospitals, schools, city offices, police stations, and every other kind of human organization. Family, relatives, neighbors, and friends relied on a broad range of interdependent organizations for everything from birth, marriage, and funerals to firefighting, productive work, and daily living. These traditional communities were completely demolished in an instant. Destroyed, that is, were not only men, women, and thousands of children, but also restaurants and inns, laundries, theater groups, sports clubs, sewing clubs, boys' clubs, girls' clubs, love affairs, trees and gardens, grass, gates, gravestones, temples and shrines, family heirlooms, radios, classmates, books, courts of law, clothes, pets, groceries and markets, telephones, personal letters, automobiles, bicycles, horses, 120 war horses, musical instruments, medicines, and medical equipment, life savings, eyeglasses, city records, sidewalks, family scrapbooks, monuments, engagements, marriages, employees, clocks and watches, public transportation, street signs, parents, works of art. The whole of society, concludes the Japanese study, was laid waste to its very foundations. Lifton's history professor saw not even foundations left. Such a weapon, he told the American psychiatrist, has the power to make everything into nothing. There remains the question of how many died. The U.S. Army Medical Corps officer who proposed the joint American-Japanese study to Douglas MacArthur thought as late as August 28th that the total number of casualties reported at Hiroshima is approximately 160,000, of which 8,000 are dead. The Jesuit priest's contemporary reckoning approaches the appalling reality and illuminates further the destruction of the common world. How many people were a sacrifice to this bomb? Those who had lived through the catastrophe placed the number of dead at least 100,000. Hiroshima had a population of 400,000. Official statistics placed the number who had died at 70,000 up to September 1st, not counting the missing, and 130,000 wounded, among them 43,500 severely wounded. Estimates made by ourselves on the basis of groups known to us show that the number of 100,000 dead is not too high. Near us, there are 2 barracks, in each of which 40 Korean workers lived. On the day of the explosion, they were laboring on the streets of Hiroshima. 4 returned alive to 1 barracks, and 16 to the other. 600 students of the Protestant girls' school worked in a factory, from which only 30 or 40 returned. Most of the peasant families in the neighborhood lost one or more of their members who had worked at factories in the city. Our next-door neighbor, Tamura, lost 2 children, and himself suffered a large wound since, as it happened, he had been in the city on that day. The family of our reader suffered 2 dead, father and son. Thus, a family of 5 members suffered at least 2 losses, counting only the dead and severely wounded. There died the mayor, the president of the Central Japan District, the commander of the city, a Korean prince who had been stationed in Hiroshima in the capacity of an officer, and many other high-ranking officers. Of the professors of the university, 32 were killed or severely wounded. Especially hard hit were the soldiers. The Pioneer Regiment was almost entirely wiped out. The barracks were near the center of the explosion. More recent estimates place the number of deaths up to the end of 1945 at 140,000. The dying continued. 5-year deaths related to the bombing reached 200,000. The death rate for deaths up to the end of 1945 was 54%, an extraordinary density of killing. By contrast, the death rate for the March 9 firebombing of Tokyo, 100,000 deaths among 1 million casualties, was only 10%. Back at the U.S. Army Institute of Pathology in Washington in early 1946, Liebau used a British invention, the standardized casualty rate, to compute that Little Boy produced casualties, including dead, 6,500 times more efficiently than an ordinary HE bomb. Those scientists who invented the atomic bomb, writes a young woman who was a 4th grade student at Hiroshima, what did they think would happen if they dropped it? Harry Truman learned of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima at lunch on board the Augusta en route home from Potsdam. "This is the greatest thing in history," he told a group of sailors dining at his table. "It's time for us to get home." Groves called Oppenheimer from Washington on August 6th at 2 in the afternoon to pass along the news. "General G, I'm very proud of you and all of your people."
"Dr. O, it went all right?"
"General G, apparently it went with a tremendous bang."
"Dr. O, when was this? Was it after sundown?"
"General G, no. Unfortunately, it had to be in the daytime on account of security of the plane, and that was left in the hands of the commanding general over there."
"Dr. O, right. Everybody is feeling reasonably good about it, and I extend my heartiest congratulations. It's been a long road."
"General G, yes, it has been a long road, and I think one of the wisest things I ever did was when I selected the director of Los Alamos."
"Dr. O, well, I have my doubts, General Groves."
"General G, well, you know I've never concurred with those doubts at any time." If Oppenheimer, who knew nothing yet of the extent of the destruction, was only feeling reasonably good about his handiwork, Leo Szilard felt terrible when the story broke. The press release issued from the White House that day called the atomic bomb the greatest achievement of organized science in history, and threatened the Japanese with a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. In Chicago, on Quadrangle Club stationery, Szilard scribbled a hasty letter to Gertrude Weiss. "I suppose you have seen today's newspapers. Using atomic bombs against Japan is one of the greatest blunders of history, both from a practical point of view on a 10-year scale, and from the point of view of our moral position. I went out of my way, and very much so, in order to prevent it. But as today's papers show, without success. It is very difficult to see what wise course of action is possible from here on." Otto Hahn interned with the German atomic scientists on a rural estate in England, was shattered.
"At first I refused to believe that this could be true, but in the end I had to face the fact that it was officially confirmed by the President of the United States. I was shocked and depressed beyond measure. The thought of the unspeakable misery of countless innocent women and children
was something that I could scarcely bear. After I had been given some gin to quiet my nerves, my fellow prisoners were also told the news. By the end of a long evening of discussion, attempts at explanation, and self-reproaches, I was so agitated that Max von Laue and the others became seriously concerned on my behalf. They ceased worrying only at 2 o'clock in the morning, when they saw that I was asleep. But if some were disturbed by the news, others were elated. Otto Frisch found at Los Alamos. Then one day, some 3 weeks after Trinity, there was a sudden noise in the laboratory of running footsteps and yelling voices. Somebody opened my door and shouted, "Hiroshima has been destroyed!" About 100,000 people were thought to have been killed. I still remember the feeling of unease, indeed nausea, when I saw how many of my friends were rushing to the telephone to book tables at the La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe in order to celebrate. Of course they were exalted by the success of their work, but it seemed rather ghoulish to celebrate the sudden death of 100,000 people, even if they were enemies. The American writer Paul Fussell, an Army veteran, emphasizes the importance of experience, sheer, vulgar experience, in influencing one's views about the first use of the bomb. The experience, Fussell means, is that of having come to grips, face to face, with an enemy who designs your death. I was a 21-year-old second lieutenant leading a rifle platoon. Although still officially in one piece, in the German war I had been wounded in the leg and back severely enough to be adjudged, after the war, 40% disabled. But even if my leg buckled whenever I jumped out of the back of the truck, my condition was held to be satisfactory for whatever lay ahead. When the bombs dropped and news began to circulate that the invasion of Japan would not, after all, take place, that we would not be obliged to run up the beaches near Tokyo, assault firing while being mortared and shelled, for all the fake manliness of our facades, we cried with relief and joy. We were going to live. We were going to grow up to adulthood, after all. In Japan, the impasse persisted between civilian and military leaders. To the civilians, the atomic bomb looked like a golden opportunity to surrender without shame. But the admirals and the generals still despised unconditional surrender and refused to concur. Foreign Minister Togo continued to pursue Soviet mediation as late as August 8th. Ambassador Sato asked for a meeting with Molotov that day. Molotov set the meeting for 8 in the evening, then moved it up to 5 o'clock. Despite earlier notice of the power of the new weapon, news of the devastation of a Japanese city by an American atomic bomb had surprised and shocked Stalin and prompted him to accelerate his war plans. Molotov announced that afternoon to the Japanese ambassador that the Soviet Union would consider itself at war with Japan as of the next day, August 9th. Well-armed Soviet troops, 1.6 million strong, waited in readiness on the Manchurian border and attacked the ragged Japanese an hour after midnight. In the meantime, a propaganda effort that originated in the U.S. War Department was developing in the Marianas. Hap Arnold cabled Spots and Farrell on August 7th, ordering a crash program to impress the facts of atomic warfare on the Japanese people. The impetus probably came from George Marshall, who was surprised and shocked that the Japanese had not immediately sued for peace. "What we did not take into account," he said long afterward, "was that the destruction would be so complete that it would be an appreciable time before the actual facts of the case would get to Tokyo. The destruction of Hiroshima was so complete that there was no communication, at least for a day, I think, and maybe longer." The Navy and the Air Force both lent staff and facilities, including Radio Saipan, and a printing press previously used to publish a Japanese-language newspaper distributed weekly over the empire by B-29s. The working group that assembled on August 7th in the Marianas decided to attempt to distribute 6 million leaflets to 47 Japanese cities with populations exceeding 100,000.
Writing the leaflet occupied the group through the night. An historical memorandum prepared for Groves in 1946 notes that the working group discovered in a midnight conference with Air Force commanders a certain reluctance to fly single B-29s over the Empire, reluctance arising from the fact that enemy opposition to single flights was expected to be increased as the result of the total damage to Hiroshima by one airplane. The proposed text of the leaflet was ready by morning, and was flown from Saipan to Tinian at dawn for Farrell's approval. Groves's deputy edited it and ordered the revised text called to Radio Saipan by inter-island telephone for broadcast to the Japanese every 15 minutes. Radio transmission probably began the same day. The text described the atomic bomb as the equivalent in explosive power to what 2,000 of our giant B-29s can carry on a single mission. Suggested skeptics make inquiry as to what happened to Hiroshima and ask the Japanese people to petition the emperor to end the war. Otherwise, it threatened, we shall resolutely employ this bomb and all our other superior weapons. Printing millions of copies of a leaflet took time, and distribution was delayed some hours further by a local shortage of T-3 leaflet bombs. Such was the general confusion that Nagasaki did not receive its quota of warning leaflets until August 10th. Assembly of Fat Man Unit, F-3-1, was progressing at Tinian in the air-conditioned assembly building designed for that purpose. F-3-1 was the second Fat Man with real high explosives that the Tinian team had assembled. The first, with lower-quality HE castings and a non-nuclear core, Unit F-3-3, had been ready since August 5th for a test drop, but would not be dropped until August 8th, because the key 509th crews were busy delivering Little Boy and being debriefed. The F-3-1 Fat Man, Norman Ramsey writes, was originally scheduled for dropping on August 11th local time. However, by August 7th, it became apparent that the schedule could be advanced to August 10. When Parsons and Ramsey proposed this change to Tibbetts, he expressed regret that the schedule could not be advanced 2 days instead of only one, since good weather was forecast for August 9, and the five succeeding days were expected to be bad. It was finally agreed that we would try to be ready for August 9, provided all concerned understood that the advancement of the date by 2 full days introduced a large measure of uncertainty into the probability of meeting such a drastically revised schedule. One member of the Fat Man assembly team, a young Navy ensign named Bernard J. O'Keefe, remembers the mood of urgency in the Marianas, where the war was still a daily threat. With the success of the Hiroshima weapon, the pressure to be ready with the much more complex implosion device became excruciating. We sliced off another day, scheduling it for August 10th. Everyone felt that the sooner we could get off another mission, the more likely it was that the Japanese would feel that we had large quantities of the devices and would surrender sooner. We were certain that one day saved would mean that the war would be over one day sooner. Living on that island, with planes going out every night and people dying not only in B-29 shot down, but in naval engagements all over the Pacific, we knew the importance of one day. The Indianapolis sinking also had a strong effect on us. Despite that urgency, O'Keefe adds, August 9th sat less well. The scientific staff, dog-tired, met and warned Parsons that cutting 2 full days would prevent us from completing a number of important checkout procedures. But orders were orders. The young Providence, Rhode Island native had been a student at George Washington University in 1939 and had attended the conference there on January 25th, at which Niels Bohr announced the discovery of fission. Now, on Tinian, more than 6 years later, on the night of August 7th, it became O'Keefe's task to check out Fat Man for the last time before its working parts were encased beyond easy access in armor. In particular, he was required to connect the firing unit mounted on the front of the implosion sphere with the 4 radar units mounted in the tail by plugging in a cable inaccessibly threaded around the sphere inside its dural casing. When I returned at midnight, the others in my group left to get some sleep. I was alone in the assembly room
with a single Army technician to make the final connection. I did my final checkout and reached for the cable to plug it into the firing unit. It wouldn't fit. I must be doing something wrong, I thought. Go slowly. You're tired and not thinking straight. I looked again. To my horror, there was a female plug on the firing set and a female plug on the cable. I walked around the weapon and looked at the radars and the other end of the cable. Two male plugs. I checked and double-checked. I had the technician check. He verified my findings. I felt a chill and started to sweat in the air-conditioned room. What had happened was obvious. In the rush to take advantage of good weather, someone had gotten careless and put the cable in backward. Removing the cable and reversing it would mean partly disassembling the implosion sphere. It had taken most of a day to assemble it. They would miss the window of good weather and slip into the 5 days of bad weather that had worried Paul Tibbetts. The second atomic bomb might be delayed as long as a week. The war would go on, O'Keefe thought. He decided to improvise. Although nothing that could generate heat was ever allowed in an explosive assembly room, he determined to unsolder the connectors from the two ends of the cable, reverse them, and re-solder them. My mind was made up. I was going to change the plugs without talking to anyone, rules or no rules. I called in the technician. There were no electrical outlets in the assembly room. We went out to the electronics lab and found two long extension cords and a soldering iron. We propped the door open so it wouldn't pinch the extension cords, another safety violation. I carefully removed the backs of the connectors and unsoldered the wires. I re-soldered the plugs onto the other ends of the cable, keeping as much distance between the soldering iron and the detonators as I could as I walked around the weapon. We must have checked the cable continuity 5 times before plugging the connectors into the radars and the firing set and tightening up the joints. I was finished. So, the next day was Fat Man. The two armored steel ellipsoids of its ballistic casing bolted together through bathtub fittings to lugs cast into the equatorial segments of the implosion sphere, its boxed tail sprouting radar antenna just as Little Boy's had done. By 2200 on August 8th, it had been loaded into the forward bomb bay of a B-29 named Box Carr, after its usual commander, Frederick Bock, but piloted on this occasion by Major Charles W. Sweeney. Sweeney's primary target was Kokura Arsenal on the north coast of Kyushu. His secondary was the old Portuguese and Dutch-influenced port city of Nagasaki, the San Francisco of Japan, home of that country's largest colony of Christians, where the Mitsubishi torpedoes used at Pearl Harbor had been made. Bock's car flew off Tinian at 0347 on August 9th. The Fat Man weaponeer, Navy Commander Frederick L. Ashworth, remembers the flight to rendezvous. The night of our takeoff was one of tropical rain squalls, and flashes of lightning stabbed into the darkness with disconcerting regularity. The weather forecast told us of storms all the way from the Marianas to the Empire. Our rendezvous was to be off the southeast coast of Kyushu, some 1,500 miles away. There, we were to join with our two companion observation B-29s that took off a few minutes behind us. Fat Man was fully armed at takeoff, except for its green plugs, which Ashworth changed to red only 10 minutes into the mission, so that Sweeney could cruise above the squalls at 17,000 feet, San Elmo's fire glowing on the propellers of his plane. The pilot soon discovered he would enjoy no reserve of fuel. The fuel selector that would allow him to feed his engines from a 600-gallon tank of gasoline in his aft bomb bay refused to work. He circled over Yakushima between 0800 and 0850 Japanese time, waiting for his escorts, one of which never did catch up. The finger plane at Kokura reported 3/10 low clouds, no intermediate or high clouds, and improving conditions. But when Bock's car arrived there at 10:44, heavy ground haze and smoke obscured the target. 2 additional runs were made, Ashworth notes in his flight log, hoping that the target might be picked up after closer observation. However, at no time
was the aiming point seen. Jacob Besser controlled electronic countermeasures on the Fat Man mission, as he had done on the Little Boy mission before. He remembers of Kokora that the Japs started to get curious and began sending fighters up after us. We had some flak bursts and things were getting a little hairy, so Ashworth and Sweeney decided to make a run down to Nagasaki, as there was no sense dragging the bomb home or dropping it in the ocean. Sweeney had enough fuel left for only one pass over the target before nursing his aircraft to an emergency landing on Okinawa. When he approached Nagasaki, he found the city covered with cloud. With his fuel low, he could either bomb by radar or jettison a bomb worth several $100 million into the sea. It was Ashworth's call, and rather than waste the bomb, he authorized a radar approach. At the last minute, a hole opened in the cloud cover, long enough to give the bombardier a 20-second visual run on a stadium several miles upriver from the original aiming point nearer the bay. Fat Man dropped from the B-29, fell through the hole, and exploded 1,650 feet above the steep slopes of the city at 11:02 a.m., August 9, 1945, with a force later estimated at 22 kilotons. The steep hills confined the larger explosion. It caused less damage and less loss of life than Little Boy. But 70,000 died in Nagasaki by the end of 1945, and 140,000 altogether across the next 5 years, a death rate like Hiroshima's of 54%. The survivors spoke with equal eloquence of unspeakable suffering. A U.S. Navy officer visited the city in mid-September and described its condition then, more than a month after the bombing, in a letter home to his wife. A smell of death and corruption pervades the place, ranging from the ordinary carrion smell to somewhat subtler stenches with strong overtones of ammonia, decomposing nitrogenous matter, I suppose. The general impression, which transcends those derived from the evidence of our physical senses, is one of deadness, the absolute essence of death, in the sense of finality, without hope of resurrection. And all this is not localized. It's everywhere, and nothing has escaped its touch. In most ruined cities, you can bury the dead, clean up the rubble, rebuild the houses, and have a living city again. One feels that is not so here. Like the ancient Sodom and Gomorrah, its site has been sown with salt, and Ichabod is written over its gates. The military leaders of Japan still had not agreed to surrender. The Emperor Hirohito therefore took the extraordinary step of forcing the issue. The resulting surrender offer, delivered through Switzerland, reached Washington on Friday morning, August 10th. It acknowledged acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, except in one crucial regard: that it does not comprise any demand which prejudices the prerogatives of His Majesty as a sovereign ruler. Truman met immediately with his advisors, including Stimson and Mearns. Stimson thought the president would accept the Japanese offer. Doing so, he wrote in his diary, would be taking a good plain horse-sense position that the question of the emperor was a minor matter compared with delaying a victory in the war which was now in our hands. Jimmy Burns persuasively disagreed. "I cannot understand," he argued, "why we should go further than we were willing to go at Potsdam when we had no atomic bomb and Russia was not in the war." He was thinking, as usual, of domestic politics. Accepting Japan's condition, he warned, might mean the crucifixion of the president. Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal proposed a compromise. The president should communicate to the Japanese his willingness to accept their offer, yet define the terms of surrender in such a manner that the intents and purposes of the Potsdam Declaration would be clearly accomplished. Truman bought the compromise, but Burns drafted the reply. It was deliberately ambiguous in its key provisions. "From the moment of surrender, the authority of the emperor and the Japanese government to rule the state shall be subject to the supreme commander of the Allied powers. The Emperor and the Japanese High Command will be required to sign the surrender terms. The ultimate form of government shall, in accordance with the Potsdam Declaration, be established by the freely expressed will of the Japanese people. Nor did Burns hurry the message along. He kept it in hand overnight and only released it for broadcast by radio and delivery through Switzerland the following morning. Stimson, still trying to bring his air force under control, had argued at the Friday morning meeting that the United States should suspend bombing, including atomic bombing. Truman thought otherwise, but when he met with the cabinet that afternoon, he had partly reconsidered. "We would keep up the war at its present intensity," Forrestal paraphrases the president, "until the Japanese agreed to these terms, with the limitation, however, that there will be no further dropping of the atomic bomb." Henry Wallace, the former vice president, who was now Secretary of Commerce, recorded in his diary the reason for the president's change of mind. Truman said he had given orders to stop the atomic bombing. He said the thought of wiping out another 100,000 people was too horrible. He didn't like the idea of killing, as he said, all those kids. The restriction came none too soon. Groves had reported to Marshall that morning that he had gained 4 days in manufacture and expected to ship a second Fat Man plutonium core and initiator from New Mexico to Tinian on August 12th or 13th. Provided there are no unforeseen difficulties in manufacture, in transportation to the theater, or after arrival in the theater, he concluded cautiously, the bomb should be ready for delivery on the first suitable weather after 17 or 18 August. Marshall told Groves the president wanted no further atomic bombing, except by his express order, and Groves decided to hold up shipment, a decision in which Marshall concurred. The Japanese government learned of Burns' reply to his offer of conditional surrender not long after midnight on Sunday, August 12th, but civilian and military leaders continued to struggle in deadlocked debate. Hirohito resisted efforts to persuade him to reverse his earlier commitment to surrender and called a council of the imperial family to collect pledges of support from the princes of the blood. The Japanese people were not yet told of the Burns reply, but knew of the peace negotiations and waited in suspense. The young writer, Yukio Mishima, found the suspense surreal. It was our last chance. People were saying that Tokyo would be atomic bombed next. Wearing white shirts and shorts, I walked about the streets. The people had reached the limits of desperation and were now going about their affairs with cheerful faces. From one moment to the next, nothing happened. Everywhere there was an air of cheerful excitement. It was just as though one was continuing to blow up an already bulging toy balloon, wondering, will it burst now? Will it burst now? Strategic Air Forces Commander Carl Spatz called Loris Norstad on August 10th, proposing placing the third atomic bomb on Tokyo, where he thought it would have a salutary psychological effect on government officials. On the other hand, continuing area incendiary bombing disturbed him. "I've never favored the destruction of cities as such, with all inhabitants being killed," he confided to his diary on August 11th. He had sent off 114 B-29s on August 10th. Because of bad weather and misgivings, he canceled a mission scheduled for August 11th and restricted operations thereafter to attacks on military targets visually or under very favorable blind bombing conditions. American weather planes over Tokyo were no longer drawing anti-aircraft fire. Spots thought that fact unusual. The vice chief of the Japanese Navy's general staff, the man who had conceived and promoted the kamikaze attacks of the past year that had added to American bewilderment and embitterment at Japanese ways, crashed a meeting of government leaders on the evening of August 13th with tears in his eyes to offer a plan for certain victory. Sacrifice 20 million Japanese lives in a special kamikaze attack. Whether he meant the 20 million to attack the assembled might of the Allies with rocks or bamboo spears, the record does not reveal. A B-29 leaflet barrage forced the issue the next morning. Leaflet bombs showered what remained of Tokyo's streets with the translation of Burns's reply. the Lord Keeper of the Privy Seal, knew such public revelation would harden the military against surrender. He carried the leaflet immediately to the Emperor, and just before 11 that morning, August 14th, Hirohito assembled his ministers and counselors in the Imperial Air Raid Shelter. He told them he found the Allied reply, "evidence of the peaceful and friendly intentions of the enemy," and considered it acceptable. He did not specifically mention the atomic bomb, even that terrific Leviathan submerged in the general misery. "I cannot endure the thought of letting my people suffer any longer. A continuation of the war would bring death to tens, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of persons. The whole nation would be reduced to ashes. How, then, could I carry on the wishes of my imperial ancestors?" He asked his ministers to prepare an imperial rescript, a formal edict, that he might broadcast personally to the nation. The officials were not legally bound to do so. The emperor's authority lay outside the legal structure of the government. But by older and deeper bonds than law, they were bound, and they set to work. In the meantime, Washington had grown impatient. Groves was asked on August 13th about the availability of your patients together with the time estimate that they could be moved and placed. Stimson recommended proceeding to ship the nuclear materials for the third bomb to Tinian. Marshall and Groves decided to wait another day or two. Truman ordered Arnold to resume area incendiary attacks. Arnold still hoped to prove that his Air Force could win the war. He called for an all-out attack with every available B-29 and any other bombers in the Pacific theater, and mustered more than 1,000 aircraft. 12 million pounds of high-explosive and incendiary bombs destroyed half of Kumagaya and a sixth of Isezaki, killing several thousand more Japanese, even as word of the Japanese surrender passed through Switzerland to Washington. The first hint of surrender reached American bases in the Pacific by radio in the form of a news bulletin from the Japanese news agency Domei at 2:49 p.m. on August 14th, 1:49 a.m. in Washington. "Flash! Flash! Tokyo, August 14. It is learned an imperial message accepting the Potsdam Proclamation is forthcoming soon." The bombers droned on even after that. But eventually that day, the bombs stopped falling. Truman announced the Japanese acceptance in the afternoon. There were last-minute acts of military rebellion in Tokyo, a high officer assassinated, an unsuccessful attempt to steal the phonograph recording of the imperial rescript, a brief takeover of a division of imperial guards, wild plans for a coup. But loyalty prevailed. The emperor broadcast to a weeping nation on August 15th. His 100 million subjects had never heard the high, antique voice of the crane before. Despite the best that has been done by everyone, the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while the general trends of the world have all turned against her interest. Moreover, the enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. This is the reason why we have ordered the acceptance of the provisions of the Joint Declaration of the Powers. The hardships and sufferings to which our nation is to be subjected hereafter will certainly be great. We are keenly aware of the inmost feelings of all ye, our subjects. However, it is according to the dictate of time and fate that we have resolved to pave the way for a grand peace for all generations to come by enduring the unendurable and suffering what is insufferable. Let the entire nation continue as one family from generation to generation. If it had gone on any longer, writes Yukio Mishima, there would have been nothing to do but go mad. An atomic bomb, the Japanese study of Hiroshima and Nagasaki emphasizes, is a weapon of mass slaughter. A nuclear weapon is, in fact, a total death machine, compact and efficient. The percentage of people killed depends simply on distance from the hypocenter. The relation between death percentage and distance is inversely proportional, and the killing, as Gil Elliott emphasizes, is no longer selective. By the time we reach the atom bomb, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ease of access to target and the instant nature of macro impact mean that both the choice of city and the identity of the victim has become completely randomized, and human technology has reached the final platform of self-destructiveness. The great cities of the dead, in numbers, remain Verdun, Leningrad, and Auschwitz. But at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the city of the dead is finally transformed from a metaphor into a literal reality. The city of the dead of the future is our city, and its victims are not French and German soldiers, nor Russian citizens, nor Jews, but all of us, without reference to specific identity. The experience of these two cities, the Japanese study emphasizes, was the opening chapter to the possible annihilation of mankind. On August 24th, having recently heard about the man holding an eyeball, Dr. Michihiko Hachiya suffered a nightmare. Like the myth of the Sphinx, destruction to those who cannot answer its riddle, whom ignorance or inattention or arrogance misleads, the dream of this Japanese doctor who was wounded in the world's first atomic bombing and who ministered to hundreds of victims must be counted one of the millennial visions of mankind. The night had been close with many mosquitoes. Consequently, I slept poorly and had a frightful dream. It seems I was in Tokyo after the great earthquake, and around me were decomposing bodies heaped in piles, all of whom were looking right at me. I saw an eye sitting on the palm of a girl's hand. Suddenly it turned and leaped into the sky and then came flying back towards me so that looking up, I could see a great bare eyeball, bigger than life, hovering over my head, staring point blank at me. I was powerless to move. I awakened short of breath and with my heart pounding. Michihiko Hachiya remembers. So do we all.
The Making of the Atomic Bomb was written by Richard Rhodes and read by Holter Graham. Editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, technical director. The associate producer was Louisa Solomon. The mix engineer was Mike DeCino. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Making of the Atomic Bomb is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also by Richard Rhodes from Simon & Schuster Audio, Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made, read by Christian Coulson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.